Hello and welcome to Golf Connections here on the new Golf Getaways digital network at playgolfgetaways.com. I'm Mitch Lawrence. All of us who love the game, every time we step up to the first tee on a course and put a peg in the ground, owe a debt of gratitude to the course designer, the man or woman who spent years passionately laboring over what will be their legacy and our gift. Today we have a chance to connect with the most talented and unique Scotsman, David McLay Kidd, who's already given us all his fair share of monumental golf playgrounds in the world's great golf destinations. Bandon Dunes in Oregon, Golf Digest's best new upscale course in America in 1999. The Castle Course in St. Andrews, and the newest of his gems, Gamble Sands in central Washington State, recently voted the 2014 best new public course in America by Golf Digest, are but three of many courses on his impressive and continuing resume. A little info on the interview, if I may. In this technological age, it can be interesting to record an interview with three people in three different cities and three computers. Sometimes it gives us a, a different audio mix at certain points, a compendium of sound effects, all of which adds, I believe, to the real-life quality of the interview as recorded. So don't mistake the somewhat heavy breathing of editor Darren Bunch, should you hear it, for anything more than a cold, though he is, as I am, a huge fan of David McLay Kidd. I hope you enjoy listening to one of the most articulate and creative architects in the game, on his course philosophy, his own amazing history in the home of golf, and his belief in making the game fun again. Here's your connection to David McLay Kidd on Golf Getaways. Today on Golf Connections, I'm happy to connect you to one of the world's great golf course architects, Mr. David McLay Kidd, a Scotsman who combines the traditions of the game and the iconic courses of his homeland with a highly unique style on his courses around the globe, creating gems like his first effort in the U.S. at Bandon Dunes, to the Castle Course in St. Andrews, Tetherow in Central Oregon, and the recently opened Gamble Sands in Washington State. His is a fascinating story from his childhood in Scotland to the succession of courses he's brought to us all, with a career that's a reflection of a man constantly changing, constantly looking to improve both his course design and his philosophy towards them. It's a pleasure to welcome to Golf Connections the award-winning David McLay Kidd, who joins me today from his home in beautiful Bend, Oregon. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you very much, Mitch. I appreciate being here.
Before we get started on the courses you've designed that have brought enjoyment to so many golfers around the world, at this point in time, the 40th Ryder Cup, as you know, has recently been played on the PGA Centenary course at Gleneagles. And given that fact and your family history at Gleneagles, it seems to be a natural jumping off point to get us started today. You grew up in Scotland at the side of your father, Jimmy Kidd, a key figure for you on and off the course on many levels. He has been one of the game's legendary greenkeepers and course managers in so many places. And though it's not where you were born, for a quarter of a century, he was in charge of managing the courses at the Gleneagles Hotel. And he was a big part of the team that was with Jack Nicklaus building the course on which the Ryder Cup was played. I'm sure you were glad to see not only the results for the European team, but Gleneagles, which was brought to a massive worldwide audience.
Well, as you say, I wasn't born there, but I spent a lot of my childhood at Gleneagles at my father's side. My father actually was the client representative for Gleneagles when Jack Nicklaus built the Ryder Cup course, which was built specifically for major championships like the Ryder Cup. And that was during my latter teenage years. So it really affected the trajectory of my life, I guess. Focused my interest in on golf design and construction, watching my father working side by side with Jack building that golf course, knowing that the best players in the world were going to come there, and seeing some of the successes they had and also some of the challenges that they encountered, and realizing what a fascinating business it was building golf courses. I was thrilled to see Gleneagles in Scotland and Perthshire show up so well on television. The weather certainly helped. I would have liked to have seen the result a little closer. The Europeans kind of ran away with it. It didn't seem like much of a match. I thought they were going to make a run for it on Sunday morning, but that was short-lived. I'm actually working with Tom Watson right now on a project who's way too classy to say anything bad, but I said to Tom that, in my opinion, he and the other vice captains should have played, and it would have been a closer match, more entertaining, and a little less whining.
I think that's perfect. That is a great, great reaction. And I love your comment about Mr. Watson. That has got to be a thrill for both of you. I'm going to speak for Mr. Watson here, that it's a thrill for him too, to be able to work together. If we can just back up a bit to your early childhood, which was obviously very different than most kids, what was your experience like growing up being around your dad in that world before Glen Eagles? As a young kid, did you just run outside and frolic on the greens? I know you had a pretty great backyard in your early years.
Well, when I was born in 1967, my father was the youngest head greenkeeper in Scotland, and he was at Glasgow Golf Club, the ninth oldest club in the world. And they had a cottage that the greenkeeper could live in that was on the left side of the sixth hole on the ninth oldest course in the world. And that's where I was born and lived the first 12 years of my life. My father went to work before dawn most mornings and came back late in the afternoon, and quite often would drive the tractor from the maintenance shop right up into the front garden. And so I was completely immersed in golf and golf course maintenance from before my earliest memories. And my father is a huge lover of the game and a student of golf course design. So laying around the house were all sorts of books and old hickory clubs and golf balls that he'd found, and just all manner of things golf. And so it was all around me, and I you know, idolized my father and still do, and so loved everything about it. I loved that he had an honest profession that was outdoors, that provided enjoyment to others, that was creative and rewarding. And I saw all of this and thought, you know, I want to be part of it. His peer group were, you know, Walter Woods, who was in charge at St. Andrews, Chris Kennedy, who was at Hags Castle, Walt Brown, who was at Turnberry. I mean, there were a whole bunch of different guys who were all the best clubs in the world. And we were going for weekends to go see family friends, but they were actually the superintendents at these other golf courses. So I was completely immersed in it. It wasn't until I was much older, when I say much older, I was probably in my early 20s, that I realized how much I had learned through osmosis from being around golf my entire life. And I put a lot of my early success down to the fact that as a 25-year-old, I had a knowledge base that probably most 45-year-olds wouldn't have had in the same business, because I'd been around it my whole life.
And it wasn't just other superintendents, greenkeepers, and authors, but what's amazing to me, your connection to the history of the game and historic architects, old Tom Morris, James Braid, Harry Colt, others. It must have been immense, and all of it becoming kind of the wallpaper of your life, so to speak.
Now that's a great way of putting it, the wallpaper of my life. It certainly was. And when my father moved to Glen Eagles in 81, the golf courses, believe it or not, were in a dire state. The hotel was run down. It had been owned by a railroad company for many generations, and it had slowly but surely declined, as had the railroad business. And new owners came in and bought it. They hired the best young enthusiastic superintendent they could find to take on the four courses that were there at that point, and bring them back to the world-class reputation that they'd had back between the wars. And so my father was tasked with that in the early 80s. And the first thing he did was go down in the basement and start to drag out all these old cloth maps that were drawn by Hutchison and Braid and others, and review them. And he became a huge student of the architecture at Glen Eagles. And so again, the wallpaper of my life became all of this historical detective work that he did, trying to figure out why these courses had been so lauded in their early years, and had been allowed to fall into decline, and what he could do in as short a period as possible to bring them back. And in short order, within 5 or 6 years, they were hosting the Scottish Open, which was the second biggest venue on the European tour next to the British Open. And he ran 8 straight Scottish Opens through the late 80s and early 90s. And again, that was all part of my latter teenage years as I watched all of this happen and started to understand the effect that the golf course designer and especially the superintendent could have on major tournaments and the average guy playing.
Given the history we're talking about, before we move on, I have to ask this question. Are you any relation to Tom Kidd, which is a pretty famous name in open history at St. Andrews?
I'm sure we must be. Scotland's not that big a country. And Tom Kidd, who your listeners may not know, was the first winner of the British Open, who was a fisherman from St. Andrews or Prestwick. I can't remember which. Maybe you know. But I'm guessing that somewhere back there we were related, but I'm not sure how.
Well, I'm going to research that. If I have to go on to Ancestry.com and find out, I will. To me, one of the great stories of the Open, 1873, and Tom Kidd winning. He won, by the way, of course, as you know, £11 for that victory.
The add-on to the story, Mitch, is that the reason he was playing in it and winning £11 was that there'd been a storm at sea and he was a fisherman. And it was too rough a day to take the fishing boats out, so he decided to play golf instead. And name immortalized for the rest of time. When I was awarded the Castle Course at St. Andrews, I was sitting in the Links clubhouse looking at all the names that are written on the wall above the windows as you look out across the Links. And the first name on the list is Tom Kidd.
What an amazing feeling that must have been. You, David, had a chance to learn every aspect of the creation of a golf course from every angle in the jobs that you had along the way. And I want to move now to the fruition of that part of your life, all those things which must have served you well. When the chance came in the mid-1990s from Mike Kaiser to do something, especially as a relatively unknown architect that was revolutionary, literally, in American golf, as Bandon Dunes became the first true Scottish-style links course in America. That design, that opportunity gave you a chance to carry your heritage, your passion to what I think would have to be literally and figuratively some truly high ground. Not a bad commission to make your mark on the game for American golfers. Tell us what that experience was like building the first of the great Bandon courses.
You know, I've had 20 years, I guess, between 94 and now to consider this. And in the last few months, I've come to an even greater understanding of the journey that I've made over these 20 years. You know, the thing about that 26-year-old that walked the sand dunes back in 1994 was he didn't know what American golf was. I hadn't spent enough time here to understand what it was that you guys were playing. I didn't see creeping bent grass greens very often in the UK. Certainly didn't see containment mounding, you know, a la Tom Fazio. I didn't see bluegrass fairways or Bermuda grass fairways with fluffy lies that the ball doesn't run on. So I saw none of that. I was unaffected by it. And so when I built Bandon Dunes, the American golf world wants to say how different it was, but it wasn't to me. It was the same. I wasn't building anything different. I was building what I'd seen my whole entire life. I'd spent my life playing golf on the links at St. Andrews and out at Old Macrahanish Golf Course. And, you know, I was used to fairways that tumbled and pitched and pot bunkers that were dotted around the landscape and wild tumbling greens that looked like a storm had just passed. So none of that was novel to me. It seemed completely normal to take the existing landforms and make as few changes as possible, put a simple grass over the top of it that liked the climate you were putting it in, which is the fescue that we now know, and do as little as possible, mow it all the same height or close to it, and hit a golf ball around it. It really wasn't that big a jump. And for me to take too much credit for Bandon, as I've said many times, is a bit like the cockerel taking all the credit for the sun rising. it was there to be found. Sure, others could have messed it up. You could have thought too hard and tried to affect it and tried to create something, and then it would have been lost. But thankfully, I didn't know enough to do that.
You know, I'm wondering, as you were talking about being 26 years old when Bend and Dunes came along, everyone, we mentioned the Ryder Cup earlier, but everyone was talking about Patrick Reed, about Jordan Spieth in the Ryder Cup. They're so young, being under the pressure of the Cup. And there obviously was something that Mike Kaiser saw in you. But did you yourself feel the pressure of landing that particular commission?
Well, again, you have to remember that nobody knew who I was, you know, anywhere. I hadn't really done anything in the UK either at that point. I was 26 years old. I'd only finished college 4 years earlier. Neither did anyone know who Mike Kaiser was. He was a guy that did greetings cards from Chicago, and he was a complete unknown in the golf world. He was pretty much off the radar, even in his own business. He wasn't an outgoing public figure by any stretch. The golf course that we were building wasn't Bend and Dunes. It didn't have a name. It was a 18-hole golf course on the southern Oregon coast that Mike wanted to come and play with his friends. And if he could get enough other people to play it, maybe he could stop the bleeding from the maintenance costs that were was inevitably going to lose. Until we were halfway through construction, nobody spoke about the potential that this could turn into what, even slightly, what we see today. Nobody thought that at all. All through the first nine holes, all we talked about was, will they build a real clubhouse or will it just be a single wide? Will there be more than one beer on the menu or will it just be Bud Light? Will there be a burger with cheese or will it just be straight burger? I mean, it was simple. I'm not kidding. Mike hoped that there would be 10,000 people would pay $35. That was his business model.
Wow. Hamburger versus cheeseburger. Two words I wouldn't have thought of when we started talking about the beginning of Bandon. Things certainly have changed from those days. Before we leave Bandon, there's an interesting story, and I know there was probably a seminal time there in terms of your work based on this story. You mentioned that you were finding the golf course, you were uncovering it, worked naturally with the land as it existed. But the story goes that on the 16th hole at Bend and Dunes, you took a bit of a risk in its design relative to Mr. Kaiser. And it's, as we know now, one of the most dramatic holes at Bend and Dunes, actually, for that matter, anywhere on the planet. Was that impactful for you at that age in terms of future work that you would do to create the 16th and the way it came about?
Well, the golf course, you know, as I look back at it, there were a number of risks. You know, when I initially met Mike, I had learned enough about the project to realize that, you know, Mike was very wealthy and, in comparison to me, obviously hugely powerful, and he could hire anyone he wanted. And so it seemed pretty obvious, even to, probably to Mike, that I was there as the token Scotsman who he would later say, well, I did talk to a Scottish golf course designer, but it didn't work out, so I hired Jack Nicklaus. So I figured I had nothing to lose. So when I met Mike for the first time after a few days wandering the land, I wouldn't say attacking him, but I was definitely standing on my heels and telling him, or my back legs, and telling him what I thought. And what I thought was, you know, if you were really serious about building a links course, you know, you wouldn't put the clubhouse out on the point, which is now 16. You know, you wouldn't put carts out there. You'd make people walk. You know, you wouldn't plant bent grass and bluegrass. You just plant the whole thing to fescue. You know, we'd take all these scrub trees and gorse out and let it all be a fescue meadow, things like that. And those were the sorts of things that, in the end, persuaded Mike to keep talking to me and allowing me to start construction. Well, that same sort of ballsy attitude ran all the way to 16. And the story that you started to allude to was, for a couple of years, we had talked about the golf hole being a certain way, And Mike left after one of his visits, and I proceeded to start building 16, and I came up with a completely different idea. And I built what you see today. And Mike flew back in about a month later expecting to see design A, and design Z was staring back at him. And I was standing on the green, and Mike had flown in with Mike Davies, the current USGA head. And Mike and he were on the two Mikes were back on the tee, and I was on the green. And I thought, you know, Mike can't help but love this. You know, this will be a moment where we walk together, and he smiles and holds out his hand and says, "You got it. You nailed it. Keep going." But actually, he spun around on his heels and he walked off back up the golf course in another direction. And I thought at that moment I was fired. But my hopes did come to fruition a couple hours later when I caught up with him, and he and Mike Davies said, "You know, awesome job. We love what you've come up with. You know, keep on going." And it was only the third or fourth hole that I'd built, so it gave me such confidence, having Mike's support, that I felt I just kept getting stronger. If I'd been playing golf, I would have been making birdies after that.
You know, I love hearing those backstories. And for anyone who's been there like me, who's lucky enough to have been to Bandon, or who goes for the first time, I know next time I go and I get to 16, that will be what jumps to my mind. Let's move on, if I may. You follow Bandon Dunes with two courses in the UK, Queenwood in England, Powers Court in Ireland, both inland layouts. And then for those of us who love Hawaii, the challenge and the success of the amazing Nanea Golf Club on the Big Island. Once again, David, your father, Jimmy, a pioneer, the use of paspalum on the entire golf course, a pretty big deal. But more importantly, in your development, he suggested a pretty big change to the 17th green complex. Tell us about that and why it was so important to you.
Well, Nanea came about when Chuck Schwab asked me to do the golf course. Fazio had actually turned it down and said that the piece of land wasn't good enough to create a great golf course on. But Chuck thought differently and called me. He didn't know me. I had just done Bandon. I think I'd just completed Queenwood at the time. And so I flew out to Hawaii for the first time ever and looked across that lava slope on the dry side of the Big Island and thought, who would be crazy enough to build a golf course on this? And I spent 3 or 4 days there with Chuck Schwab and his partner, George Roberts. And for 3 or 4 days, I kept saying, I can't do this. I mean, I've never built a golf course on a mountainside, much less a lava strewn mountainside on effectively a desert. You know, I have no clue how to do this. And the more I kept protesting, the more they kept telling me, you know, it was just technical things that I needed to understand. The design stuff was the same wherever I was. And I think it was Chuck who pointed out that, you know, anybody that was going to have doubts about my skills would probably use the fact that Bandon Dunes was so relatively easy. And, you know, creating Bandon Dunes over dunes on the ocean is probably the easiest sort of golf course for any golf course designer to do. However, building a great golf course over on the side of a mountainside is much, much harder. So he kind of laid down a challenge that I couldn't resist but pick up. When I really got down to it, though, I was on the side of a mountain. And a mountain runs at, you know, 10% slope from side to side, pretty much standard right across it. So every time you think you're on a flat piece of ground, you're actually still falling towards the ocean. And so when I got to the 16th hole, a downhill, severely downhill par 3, I had a huge challenge trying to pitch the green back to play because it had to pitch back into the slope. So my first attempt, I let the green fall away from you very slightly. And my father came and visited and told me that I had it completely wrong and I needed to change it. So I made a very small change, not drastic enough, and completed the golf hole, grew it in. Chuck and George came out on one of their visits. We went up to play that hole. We all played great shots. The balls hit the middle of the green and then disappeared off the back. So we all got another ball. We all played to the front of the green. The ball rolled off down through the green and off the back. We all took out more balls. Well, you get the point. point, all the balls were gone, not one of them stayed on the green. And it was costing about $1.5 million a hole. So it's pretty expensive. Oops. And Chuck said, well, that was all he said. Well, and I swallowed hard and said, can I have a mulligan? And he said, okay. And that was the only thing that was ever said. And the minute they left, I brought the dozers back in and I rebuilt 17 completely. It doesn't look anything like the first two tries I had. So I had the first go and my dad gave me a small mulligan, and then I had a second go and Chuck gave me a much bigger mulligan. But third time was a charm, and the hole works just fine now, and it does pitch back towards you now.
You then move on to the Fantail Resort course in South Africa, the private TPC of San Francisco Bay at Stonebray, and that brings us to the seventh course in St. Andrews, the Castle course. Tell us about what that commission meant to you, the challenge of creating something new on such a historic site in golf, the marriage of the old and the new, on a site which you said wasn't the best.
Yeah, it wasn't the best. The site was 220 acres of barren potato field with a water treatment facility right in the heart of it on the coastline. So I had about just less than a mile of coastline, and a half mile into it was a huge sewer plant. So it wasn't the easiest site, but you know, being a Scot, and probably I think I was the only Scot in the short list of 20, I obviously wanted to do it. And I obviously wanted to do the very best I could on a relatively mediocre site. The best thing it had were the views back across the water to Carnoustie and then back into the old ancient city of St. Andrews. So those were the aces on the hole that I had. But the negatives were the relatively mundane terrain that I was starting with. So I had about 3 years, I think, between getting the commission and actually starting the work. And over that 3 years, I came to the conclusion, having thought about it many times, that there was no winning. You know, if I built a golf course that was benign and didn't offend anyone and was complete vanilla, it would achieve nothing. No one would ever say it was good, bad, or indifferent. It would just be vanilla. If I built something bold, if I'm lucky, 50% of people love it and 50% hate it, and I have to deal with both sides of it. The town of St. Andrews is a very fractious town. I don't think there's many places on earth with so many smart people in such a small space. It's run by the university, not by the golf course. And everyone has an opinion, probably a very good one, a very articulate one at least. And so in the end, having thought about this for years and talked to my friends, family, my father, of course, I came to the conclusion that there was only one person I had to satisfy, and that was me. Because that was the only way I could live with myself, was to build something that I thought was great and then accept that it would probably be long after my demise that anybody else might think that it was great. And so that's what me and my small team went after. We tried to create something bold, something that could stand the test of time, something that could be a foundation for a course that could stand next to the old, the new, the Jubilee, and could take another 500 years to refine, as the old course has, 600 in fact. And so that's what we did. And everything that I assumed would happen has pretty well come to pass. You know, it provokes reaction. The course, I would say about 70 or 80% of people enjoy it, and about 20% of people find it brutally hard and just, you know, very a real test. But as I say, 80% of people go back and play it. The course is full. It's been a commercial success for the Lynx Trust. And I have no regrets of having done it. It did make me a little war weary when I was asked by the Olympic Committee to put a pitch in for the course in Rio. I declined pretty much entirely because of my experience with the Castle course. I just didn't want to live through the bureaucracy and the controversy again. I think once in a lifetime is enough.
Well, we are certainly grateful for the one. Next is the stunning Tetherow Golf Course in Bend, Oregon, and some similar reactions to that course as those you mentioned at the Castle Course. Castle Course and Tetherow both brought an interesting array of reviews. Tetherow, another chance, another type of palette for your artistic nature, the high desert of Central Oregon, which obviously you loved so much, you moved there. And I know that I've talked to him many times about this, Golf Getaways editor Darren Bunch, and he has played all over the world, counts Tetherow as one of his favorite courses in the world, and says that it's a mix of a great challenge and great fun. Others originally talked about the difficult nature of playing the course, though they loved the look of it. I know there were a few changes made to Tetherow since it was built, but at the time, was that a reflection of a point in your career relative to the boldness of a golf course?
They were built simultaneously. So my thinking back then in sort of 2006 and 7 was obviously similar. I guess I would thread it at this point in my life, I would thread it all the way back to Bend and Dunes. And what I think I've come to appreciate or understand is that when I built Bend and Dunes, I was a 20-something-year-old Scotsman who had a huge amount of golf experience in the UK, and especially in Scotland, and very little elsewhere in the world. I hadn't really played that many golf courses at that point outside of the British Isles. And so my ideas of what is good were influenced heavily by those old courses. By the time I get to build the Castle and Tetherow in 2006, you know, it's 10 years later, 12 years later, and I'm successful at what I do. People pay attention to what I do. I'm being hired because of that success. And back at that point, what is success? The magazines are telling me and every developer that success is based on the resistance to scoring, the defense of par, the visual drama that lays out in front of you. Probably fashionable things at that time, but that was what was influencing me. And I think I was seduced by those things. I was led in that direction thinking, well, the Castle Course opened as development of the year. Tetherow won best new golf course in the United States at a time when there was still massive competition. So critically, I was acclaimed by those courses. I look back at it now and I think that the golf course industry kind of lost the plot. You know, we started to build courses that were all too difficult. We were watching Tiger Woods win everything in his path. Everyone was talking about tiger proofing and making courses harder and harder. Everyone was decrying the advancements in technology with the ball and the clubs. And so everything that a young golf course architect was hearing was make it harder, make it harder. That's what people want. That's what your client wants. And in hindsight, I think that we were running headlong up a dark alley.
Fascinating and honest. Thank you for those insights. Maybe a bit of a change in philosophy starting to be evident. Next, with Huntsman Springs in Idaho, you called it an enormous course, big sky, wide fairways, large greens, and that will come into play in just a second. Next, you went to Macrahanish Dunes on the west coast of Scotland. That's a subject to me for a whole different show. I want to hear the stories about playing in the dunes as a kid at your summer home. Another great honor for you with a course by old Tom and J.H. Taylor. You go to Fiji and really get away from it all to design the Luakala Island Resort there. And then that brings us to this fantastic course in central Washington, Gamble Sands, which opened in 2014. You call it on your website, and I quote, unadulterated golf, as playable as Bend and Dunes and a challenge for good players, but one where the average player never loses a ball. And I know, before I ask you about it, David, that one of our Golf Getaways contributors, Blaine Noonan, was up there with you recently. He called it historic, which I think is pretty interesting. He said that it was the first time a highly visible architect didn't talk at all about a new course being a tremendous test for the good golfer and a potential site for a major championship. I'm just imagining his tone of voice. And you told him, I worried too much about resistance to par when I should have been worrying about people having fun. And Blaine concluded his piece for Golf Getaway saying, for me and most ordinary players, Gamble Sands is perfect. For me, reading about it and what people have said, it sounds like you want to strike a completely different tone in the world of golf.
Well, I think that if you look back at sort of 07, 08, even 09, the word fun in golf course circles would have been considered passé, you know, the kind of thing that a once-a-month hacker might say, whether he had fun or not. The elite golfer didn't talk about having fun. They talked about challenge. And, you know, they talked about it in terms of, you know, almost misery, like hiking up a mountain in the wintertime. You know, forgotten that golf was supposed to be fun, supposed to be socials. You're supposed to come off of it and think, I want to do it again, not come off of it and think, oh, that was horrible. That had all gone, and we were forgetting that. So in 2010, I actually went down to Nicaragua, and I built a golf course for a gentleman called Carlos Pelas, who's an incredible guy, and he doesn't play golf. And he said to me, you know, we got on so well. He said, I trust you implicitly. You build what you think, you know, I need to have at my resort here. And I said, I want to build you a completely playable golf course that you and your friends and others in Central America can start to enjoy golf and learn to love it the way that I did as a kid. So I built a 6,700-yard, 18-hole golf course, super wide, simple strategy. There's lots of banks to hit the ball off. There's soft shapes on the greens that you can easily read. And the golf course isn't particularly long. It came out so well. Everyone that plays it, and of course it's in a remote location, so it isn't that many people, but everyone I took down, everyone that I ever heard going down there, had great fun. Adam Scott and Jeff Fogelvie go over there all the time. They surf, they play golf, they love it. And when I came back to the US after building it, I thought, this is so right. This is what people want. I'm not going to listen. I'm not going to take this seduction anymore. The next course I do, I'm going to follow the same lines I was on. I'm going to make sure that the good golfer, the single-digit golfer that's chasing birdies, still has a challenge. He's looking to make it on a tight line, to give himself the best angle in, to put it close to the pin, to hole a putt for birdie. The average golfer, he only hits, you know, maybe he hits two good shots in a row. When does he ever hit three good shots in a row? The average guy doesn't hit three good shots in a row. So can I take responsibility for that third shot every now and then and give him a friendly bounce back into play? Can I make sure that when he is completely offline, I recover him and make sure that he continues to play and have fun? And that's the ethos that I came up with. I said to my guys on the ground, let's come up with an interesting, challenging hole for the low handicapper. And then once we have that concept down, how do we make sure that everybody else can get through the hole? How do we make sure that their worst shot has the best chance of recovery? Because I'm happy to give anyone a bogey. I have no problem letting you shoot bogey golf all day long. I don't want you to make double bogey, and I definitely don't want you to lose a golf ball. So what can I do to help you do that? And so we sat down over a couple of years, really, and we thought through in immense detail, how do you do that? And it's a lot more complex than you would think, you know, to try and come up with ways of making a golf course inexpensive to build, sustainable in its long-term maintenance, challenging to a low handicapper, huge amount of fun for everybody else, walkable for everyone. Those are all things that are you want them, but they're not easy to reach. You really have to think hard to get there. And so with Gamble, we took 2 summers to build the course, and we constantly went back and refined over and over again every detail. I don't think I've ever done a course where I spent so much time sweating over such tiny details as I did there. You know, I played it last October when we just finished grassing it with Kevin Chappell, who's ranked, he was 50 on the FedEx list. And I was really interested to see how Kevin would play as one of the world's top players. You know, would he just take it apart? And he played it twice in one day and shot 68. And he was ranked, you know, top 100 in the world, 50th on the FedEx list. So 68 from a top player on planet Earth, I felt was a great indication that the course is no pushover. You know, you still have to play well if you're going to shoot in the low 60s. You would have to have a lights out day. It's no pushover. But if you're a 10 handicap, you might break 80. And I can't tell you the number of people that have come to me and they've said, Gamble Sands is my personal best. That I shot my lowest score there. And to the point that when I wrote the course guide for Bandon Dunes, I finished it with what's turned out to be kind of an immortal line. Bearing in mind, I wrote this in 98, the year before the course opened. I finished off the course guide with, this is golf as it was truly meant to be. And Mike Kaiser took that line and he used it on all sorts of merchandise. It's become the tagline for Bandon Dunes, golf as it was meant to be. When I did Gamble Sands and they asked me to write the course guide, I thought, you know, this is a seminal moment in my career, coming full circle from Bandon Dunes all the way back to Gamble Sands. And that's how I feel. You know, what can I say? I don't want to steal the line golf as it was meant to be. And so the line that I used there at the very end was, I want you to play your best golf here. And I think that for me sums up the sea change in my mind that I want to promote to my fellow golf course designers. How can we get golfers to play their best golf here? Because if you do, golf will turn a corner, people will play more and have fun more, and this industry and game that we love will blossom.
I don't know how you could put it any better than that. And I, for one, can't wait to play my best golf there. One final thought before we let you go. The team to you is obviously important. You have a fantastic one at DMK Golf Design, starting with your dad. You've worked with many great people on previous projects. I know Jim Haley, who's now finally getting ready to build Pacific Gales south of Bandon, which I know already will be a welcome addition to the Oregon golf scene. How does it make you feel to be in a position to see the people who've joined you along the way on your own journey and on some of your projects take on their own projects like Pacific Gales? I would imagine it would give you an enormous sense of pride.
Enormous, absolutely enormous. For, you know, so many people have played a great role in my life, and what if I've been able to give them something back, then I'm hugely blessed and grateful. Jim Haley, without Jim Haley, I probably wouldn't be here today. You know, Jim Haley built Bandon's, he built Nanea, he built Queenwood. You know, he was the guy on the ground. When I came up with an idea, it was Jim that nodded his head and climbed back in the dozer and actually made it a reality. You know, so many of these projects were really collaborations with Jim. He's an unsung hero in the golf business for sure. And when he gets Pacific Gales underneath his tracks, I'm sure that he and his team on that are going to create something exceptional. I spoke to Jim only a couple of days ago, and he was telling me how things were going. And I, you know, I want to see him build something absolutely incredible. I know that he can. And he's one of a number of people that I've had the huge privilege of working with in this business. It's not easy. You know, it may seem to a golfer as a wonderful pastime or a career. But these guys spend years away from their family and friends. You know, you have to be incredibly passionate about it in order to make it worth your while. They often aren't paid huge sums of money. They're working in difficult conditions. There's no glory at the end of it. You don't know when your next job's coming. So it's more often than not, for the vast majority of people in my business, it's all about their passion for the game of golf and nothing else, because they rarely get much else.
That is a wonderful way to put it, David. I hope we can have you back with us here on Golf Connections. I know the Golf Getaways listeners and anyone who travels to play this great game are grateful, as I am, for everything you've given us. You're not just an artist as an architect, but a poet in your ability to describe your work and your life. I can't thank you enough, David, for giving us so much of your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
I hope our fairways cross soon, and I'll wear my kilt if you wear yours.
All right. Thanks, Mitch.
There he goes, Mr. David McClay Kidd, and what a treat that was. You all can follow David on Twitter at DMKGolfDesign or on his fantastic website, dmkgolfdesign.com, and I would urge you to do that. It is really complete and incredibly thorough website with a ton of information about everything David and his team have done and will be doing. We'll talk to you next time on Golf Connections here on the Golf Getaways Digital Network at playgolfgetaways.com. Thanks for being with us. I'm Mitch Lawrence. As we say in the world of hickories, far and short. Sure.